It's good to see you again, William.
Fantastic to see you again, Diana. So I'm pretty excited about hanging out with you today and chatting about a lot of interesting topics.
Yeah, including the smart IT buyer-seller workspace construct, which I have written down here, so I'll make sure I got the words right. Can you tell me more about that?
So interesting genesis. So I have a technical background. So I started over 2.5 decades ago in technology. So everything from the infrastructures to compute, virtualization, all the way into security. And the last decade or so, I've been doing a lot of work with very large national resellers and solution integrators and consultants who help implement and design technology solutions for customers. So everything on the IT side and everything on the cybersecurity side. So I've just been noticing a lot of trends here in the last couple of years where there's just a lot of noise in the technology marketplace. So from IT standpoint, I'm just noticing the CIOs, CTOs, and CISOs, them and their team are spending a lot of time trying to vet new technology, bring it in-house, implement it, operationalize it, and just bring value back to the business. So I just had an idea. I wanted to talk to cool people in the industry, people from marketing, people from sales, from the large organizations. And then for the folks who are bringing innovation to the marketplace, a lot of the startups talk to the founders on what inspired them to come out with this new technology and go out there. Because I'm really trying to help IT better support their business. Best way to do that, I think, in a lot of cases, is help talk to the people who actually sell the technology in the marketplace and see how they can help IT. So that's kind of the genesis of it.
Opposite of me here, like that's my goal. Is I'm not actually in IT. I'm more of what you call being around it. So, and my goal has been increasingly getting to know the people who are buying IT and cybersecurity products so that I can help them more, be better at my job, help anyone who's building these kinds of innovative solutions, or even just like upscaling legacy solutions, just help them understand the actual value to people. Because you people are kind of pretty cool. You are not just kind of, you people are pretty cool. That's one of the reasons why I stay in this particular niche is I've already told you, I just like hanging out with people like you.
And that's cool because, right, you have cool, awesome, very smart people in IT and they need technology to help enable their businesses and organizations do something new. They're not going to build it themselves necessarily, right? So they need to go out to the marketplace and figure out what's available. So there's this huge disconnect between finding what they need and just the entire experience of finding the right company and then navigating the whole selling process, which has become very cumbersome. So I think we on both sides of the ledger, to both the buyer side and the seller side, both sides can improve that to make the experience better. So I have a problem. I need some way for the people who are innovating to find me and then make the evaluation process a little bit smoother, make the purchasing process a little bit easier, and then speed up that process of actually implementing this technology so they can show the value back to the businesses.
It's a very succinct description. So what would you like to see? Like how would you like that marketplace to look? Like from end to end, you someone approaches you, you find it on a specific place. Like, can you take me from there?
Yes, interesting, because I always get back to this place of you're sitting in the coffee shop mm-hmm. discussing a challenge with your business, with your colleague. And as you're discussing this challenge, right, it could be in terms of business's challenges, compliance issues, competitive issues, but it's in their natural language. And I want these two people to be speaking, and I want somebody who in the market who sells and innovates to overhear this conversation. So this is even before we get to, hey, I need a new cool website, or I need to invest money to go to a conference, or I need Facebook ads. This is you are sitting, minding your business, and you overhear a conversation. And what intrigues you is something clicks in your brain is, I'm understanding the problem that they're speaking of. And I think I have a way to approach it that potentially could solve that problem. So in essence, I want to get to that space where we get rid of the layers of saying, let me tell you about how great my solution is Let me listen. So very important in that scenario. This means if you're overhearing a conversation to a challenge you can't solve, guess what? I'm not going to solicit them. I'm not going to take their email. I'm not going to invite them on a webinar because I don't need to. Because what I do or somebody else does with their solution as a seller, I'm looking for people with problems that I have solutions to. So it's that marriage of solutions finding the right types of problems.
Right. And sometimes I've heard it in a similar way, but like, honestly, if you go back to where marketing started, or like, it's not really where marketing started, but the heyday of marketing with Ogilvy and some of those guys in the 60s, the Mad Men era, they would actually say things like, why are you wasting your time writing copy? Just write down what people have said about it. And then, but we don't have, even if we listen to gong calls and we read the transcripts from our sales, we're still not really looking at it that way, because we're taking notes after we've already tried to make a hard sell on a problem they may not have.
And that's true. And the challenge is, a salesperson in that situation thinking, oh, it's not a good fit. They're incentivized by their organization to keep pushing. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of internal pressures inside organizations that sell these solutions to go places where they shouldn't, continue long past when they should. So let's go back to how is the model for the business for the seller constructed.
Right. So we're talking about the smart IT model now. I want to make sure, let's highlight some terms that you gave me here.
Yeah, definitely. So okay. So every time IT departments look for a solution to a business challenge, they'll figure out some processes, maybe how people may be involved. And a lot of times in our day and age, there's a digital component to it. So once you start talking about digital component, that is technology. That could be an HR system. That could be a ticketing system. That could be a mobile device system. But there's a lot of complexity with those digital capabilities that IT has to translate. Internally, they're hearing about these business challenges. We need to send people home to work. The implication from a technology standpoint. So they're describing what they look at. They got the enterprise architecture, figuring out what capabilities do we need based off our business requirements. And then at that point, when they come out with an approach, they say, we need some technical capabilities in these particular areas to make something happen. At that point, they have to now start that process. They go into the technology market and say, I need services, maybe some products, maybe some services themselves to meet this need. And that's where the challenge and fun happens, right? It's a very, very complicated and noisy experience. So even now, if you go to Google a solution, Google Ads, the sellers are buying that. Once your CIO Googles something for a particular problem, now magically he's getting the email or she's getting the LinkedIn notification off that simple Google search. So now the market now is looking for them to say, hey, that's a signal. And in marketing, people love the term signal,
right?
To say.
Because also, you know, if you visit, a lot of companies pressure their marketing teams early on to put pixels and other kinds of tracking methods on their websites, their LinkedIn profiles, anywhere. Well, I'm not sure about LinkedIn, but we can tell when you visit the LinkedIn though. We're pressured to put pixels on our website so we can track you if you visit. Usually those are companies with a little bit more money, because then they do something called ad roll, and every time you go to a new website, you still see the ad for that company. So is that that type of noise?
Now, because they've heard it, mm-hmm. but their response can be very brute force. It's like, hey, can I meet you? Can I show you a demo of my product? Hey, can I come out and visit? It's too much too fast, because there are internal requirements that the seller doesn't know about just yet. But they want to meet the person to get introduced to them and their teams to learn more to see if it's a good fit. So that process is very kludgy, and it's long and it's dragged out, because not only is one seller out there looking for those signals, there could be tens and hundreds and thousands of others as well. So now,
when do you think would be, sorry to interrupt you. When do you think would be a good time for someone to reach out? And do you think that all of these methods that we're doing to track you and see who you are they working at all?
Brute force, right? A period of time, the market's big enough. You hit enough people.
Right.
You hit 100 people in a day. Maybe you get one or two, and that's considered successful. Because eventually you'll get to a human. You'll eventually get to a meeting or a demo, or maybe you'll get them invited out to like an event or something. But it's very, very not scientific necessarily.
So basically, we're penetration testing.
We are. We're spraying out. We're praying and spraying out there. Anybody. Now, what some of the people are doing is saying, you know what? We've heard the problems and challenges in the market, and we're going to do education as opposed to trying to pray and spray. So we've identified a type of problem, and the type of people who have this type of problem might be in certain areas. So we're going to develop content, and we're going to put our thought leaders out there in the field to educate.
Well, that can have a huge range, because a lot of the content you have your SEO content, which tends to be talking about the basic problem and basic how to solve it in the way that now AI can deliver. And you have your thought leadership that you put in external articles, and it'll just cover bullet points and give you an overview. Do you think any of that's working, or you would like that to go a lot deeper? Can you tell me what you're looking for there?
Yeah, to make it faster, right? Because if I got something that doesn't fit with you, I don't want to waste time. I need to go find somebody. I need to go find the people who have the type of problem that my solution is built for, which gets into how did you build the solution in the first place?
Okay, so you do want to see more content on how and why we built something, and do you prefer it to be really when you're doing discovery? Do you prefer it to be really high level or start to go in deep into the tech?
Tell me how the actual people and the organizations will interact with your solution. So it's not how fast it is, how much it costs, how easy it is. It goes back to that conversation at the coffee shop. Maybe the conversation was, hey, we have these long lines at our cashiers at our 1,000 stores across the country, and the lines are too long. We're hiring more people physically to come in and do more cashiers. Maybe we need another way to take some of those people off the line and digitally allow them to actually purchase to move the line through faster. Something like that, right?
So that sounds right. That sounds kind of similar to how I've heard another security buyer speak of things. He wanted, like he says, what's missing. I'm trying to remember everything he said, but basically he needs to be able to sell to his board or CIO, CFOs, whoever is at the top that's above the security buyer. They want to know the business case. They want to know how many fewer or more people they're going to need to hire, who they're going to need to deal with. So you're getting at that level,
right? You have to translate that, right? You want to make sure you're building the right type of solution. I need notice it affects the dwell time of people waiting in line, and that's important for enough people. Maybe I'm building some type of technical solution that allows you to streamline the number of workers you have to put on the front line. And you put that in the description when you talk to people, that's a very natural conversation. Oh man, you got so many people waiting here. You know, with the new mobile apps, you can speed up this process. Maybe you can convert more of these people online before they even drive to your store. And then you'll have some obvious, what you call it, objections, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're building your solution, you have these objections that for your target customer in mind already. And you describe it in story format to let them know, here are some of the challenges and how we get around that up front in a natural way. So when you get to like, oh man, that's interesting. And as you listen to it, it's like, oh, they understand what it looked like in a retail space and a digital space. And they're talking a language that makes sense. So if they say, yes, come on in, they'll be able to help their internal colleagues also ask questions and inquire about what your solution looks like.
Right. And I like that kind of analogy, talking about the retail space. And can we take it a step further? So we should also do our storytelling initially around certain verticals and use cases to make it like easier to understand.
Correct. Because maybe it works great in retail, but maybe it doesn't work great in healthcare okay. or in construction. So this is leading to you when you're building this solution, you're figuring out what industry this really, really helps out. Because if it's too generic and too broad, you know, you should actually go to market with this solution. It could be lost in the noise. But maybe you solving a very specific problem in healthcare versus retail, retail versus legal, legal versus entertainment. Because you really, really want to know what this problem is and feel comfortable that you can make something at a quality standard that you can actually put into a business model where you can function, that you can support it and innovate over a period of time. So we'll probably get into this here, but if you build a business model that's weak with a great product, you can be out of business in 2 or 3 years.
No, exactly. So it's like, if you're selling to everyone, you're selling to no one. Like I've had this conversation a lot, and a lot of marketers, and then the salespeople get a little bit of afraid of missing opportunity. So they're like, I'll just grab everyone in the beginning. And maybe you can do that a little bit when you're trying to find product market fit, but they usually, there's a point where they start going up a little bit and then, but I've heard the analogy of, I don't know whether it's dominoes or bowling, you knock one pin down, then you can grab, or one domino over, then you can take the next one and the next one, but you got to get that domino or pin over first. You can't just, maybe you're not a good enough player to get them all done. And maybe you don't, but also on a team size, we're going back to teams. If you have a small team when you're marketing and selling, we can't market and support all of those different use cases.
Yes.
That's hard work just to get one article or one campaign or one thought, the one continuous thought going.
Yeah. And that's important too, correct? If you scale too fast and you may be hiring too many people too fast, and then guess what? And then a year later, you say, you know what? Oh, we may have to reduce our size of our force. We're struggling to meet our numbers. Well, you move the numbers up and hire more people because you thought you could scale it. But even if you can scale it and sell more, maybe you're scaling so fast, you can't support the back-end infrastructure to keep a high quality for support. Maybe a customer support starts to suffer. And a lot of times, this is how you build the business model for can you support it. So you may need to be happy with a certain number of customers, say per quarter, per year. Now, one of the challenges, obviously, if you get outside money, they're going to want a big return in a certain period of time. And they put a lot of pressure to say, every quarter, you need to grow like this.
I've seen that too. But then I've also seen, so I've seen that kind of pressure where I go into an early stage startup and the founding team gets pressure from the VCs to grow a lot faster than they really need to, but they don't even have like again, their product, they got funding for a reason. The product is there, kind of, like it's early stage, but it's there. When you hire all those salespeople and all those advisors and two marketing people, they can't sell that story. They can't market it. And then the founders get really, really stressed, and it kind of trickles down to where everybody's stressed. But then I've seen it where bootstrapped companies were just comfortable with these few little people, and everyone just worked like it was in Santa's workshop. But then we've also seen like the third case scenario, and this is where I'm getting at here, is when I wondered how it affected the cybersecurity industry from the opposite perspective of I'm seeing. Because what I'm seeing is internally they hired too many people, or maybe they just didn't have enough resources for what they were really trying to do, and it caused a lot of internal stress. But what is it doing to our? What I want to know is what it's doing to our customers, because that's what I try to say. Of like, okay, we need to always show that we're showing value. We need to show up to these people. They need to be more than just a sale. Can you feel it when you've had too many salespeople and you're not getting enough support, or the messaging that attracted you ended up not going through all the way down the line?
Yeah, also good points, because think about it. Because a founder tells a story better than anybody.
Who does?
The founder.
Right, but it's usually their vision, which is not the same thing as what the product actually does right now.
Right, if you got the founder in their coffee shop overhearing, they're crafting their product to meet that need. If they go in front of people, they say, you're fantastic. And then maybe the next person hired knows the founder and they tell the story fantastic. Or you start to scale and hire faster. The new people being hired may not be able to tell that story as well. So if you're scaling, what do? You hire maybe like an enablement team. So now you're going to create all this material so the new people can learn it. And then you go out to the field and tell that story. Well, maybe it's not as good. So a year, 2 years, 3 years later, the founder's efficacy of telling that story isn't as good down here as it was the way they did it.
Right, because there's also like when at the early stage, you're not only buying a product, like these early adopters from these little founder, even if it's like an old product, but old product type, you know, not a stereotypical early stage product, even if it's an older kind of product, but it's a small little team and they're doing things a little bit differently. Maybe it's a boutique and that's what someone really wants. Even so, you're buying the founders and their vision a little more than you're buying the actual product. So when you hire like salespeople and marketers trying to pitch a product, they can only do so much because they're not that person that people want. Like Sam Altman comes in, you know, he's created all these other companies, but they have to still use his name or people will be like, well, what in God's name is this?
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Because they love the vision and then the technology gets implemented and it's not meeting the need exactly like it matches the vision. Then you start to get customer resentment. It's like, whoa, we spent 9 months implementing this, retraining our people. We got this thing and we're using it, but it's not doing what we thought. That vision, you want the vision and capabilities to match, or let's do another scenario. Maybe the technology is working exactly like the vision showed itself to be. But then you need to keep up to date, right? You need to add compatibility with other systems. So you need a big enough technical staff in the background to keep coding, keep development, keep innovating. But maybe there's pressure on how many new engineers or coders, developers you can hire. And you're hiring salespeople. So now the founder has to figure out how many technical people do I hire on the back end? How fast? How many people in the front end? And then the marketer person knocked on the door and said, hey, I want to run another campaign and I'm going to go to that big conference. So They're getting all this pressure to scale in multiple ways. And all of a sudden you can scale too fast. Now I start to come back to the concept of if you have a solution to a great or a really challenging problem, maybe you want to have a controlled growth, right? So I mean, you need the right type of investor. Controlled growth.
Oh, yeah.
Right. This means if I need 3 people to build this great thing, build it, deliver it, and support it, that's how much I can grow. So we're going to purposely constrain ourselves to make sure a year from now, our customers are very, very happy and we can actually support it. Because guess what happened when they say they're happy with it? They'll refer to their friends. So somebody who never saw a Facebook ad or your website will say, I had this exact same problem and I used these guys.
Exactly. And I hear a lot of you security buyers and now I'm saying that if you have a better term, let me know. But I know that we used to always just say CISOs and I know your title wasn't CISO and most of the people I talk to, their title isn't CISO, but it's close. But security buyer would be the term.
What could be multiple buyers, right? Because there's somebody who signed a check.
Security buying teams.
Right. But it has so every piece of technology embeds inside of an organization. And they have different effects. So they have operational effects, impacts, might require training for a lot of people. Say like phishing software. Maybe I have 10,000 people who need to do training. Can we train their phishing software? So that's work that people have to do inside the organization, even afar from IT itself. So every time you add something new, update something new that's technology related, you need to know the impact on the organization itself. So what that means is if we install that technology and it's kind of working, it's more than just a cyber person. It might be more than an IT person. It could be the compliance person. It could be the legal person. So what you're seeing now is these much longer sales cycle for all technology because there's more stakeholders involved now. Nobody wants to write a quick check and find out, oh my God, this doesn't work. So I'm going to ask everybody that the technology touches, let's get your input. So you can imagine what that does to this.
So now we're talking about the the security buyer's buying journey with like the whole teams. So let's say that I'm representing like technology leaders, or start that over. What can I say about that? So let's say I'm representing like a new type of technology. How can we help the security leaders on their buying journey?
So you do the heavy lift. You need to understand how this integrates into inside of an organization. So we used to talk about the old thing of sellers, you know, listening more than talking. Mm-hmm. The more you understand how that business, the business works, how their people work, their culture, the better it is for you to put the solution in place and implement it correctly, enough training, enough hands-on, make sure all the testing up front is done. So when this is handed off and goes live, it's going to work there. Because you want to know that's not, the security technically bought it, but then maybe the network operations centers, the NOC, has an aspect to it beyond the SOC. And then maybe compliance teams need to interface with that. So now it's getting larger and larger beyond the initial people who maybe evaluated the technology. So maybe the technology works great, mm-hmm. but the organization in the structure in a way to actually use it. Used to be like some customers had the great SIM software. It was fantastic. Swift Army Knife could do anything you wanted to do. But you had to get evangelists inside your company to get training. And if one or two people, if that one or two people who knew it left, and then you asked for new capabilities, the solution could do it, but you may not have the people inside in the house to actually do it themselves. They may leave that over a certain period of time. So this technology can't actually innovate and adapt inside your organization because it wasn't ready for it. And it's siloed with one or two technical people who know how to actually operationalize it over a period of time.
So would you say this was a problem because the technology was too complicated, or because maybe the documentation wasn't good?
It was a mismatch of the organization wasn't ready for it. So say I need three technology solutions, two IT systems and one security solution, but it's budget season. And internally, you're worried about use it or lose it. So you put your bids in, and maybe all three projects get funded. But then you look at the CISO, you're like, man, I don't have time to get this to the third quarter of the next year. So I'm not going to spend it. And then maybe the accounting team say, you guys said you wanted it this year. Are you ready for it? So maybe it's an internal pressure to buy it before you can actually implement it, which means it can sit for
a maturity issue. How do we as sellers really know when you're mature enough? Like how do we figure that out?
People need to have a system view. How does your solution fit in? How do you operationalize it? How hard it is? So when you have initial discussions from the buyer side, do you think they're mature enough to actually take your technology and be successful? And you get a good sense of it, right? Because from a technical standpoint, and then just a user experience, you have a good feel for, can this organization absorb and be successful? If not, maybe your business model is, no problem. Can we have additional maybe managed services? Maybe we have a consulting arm that does organizational change management. Maybe we have consultants who can do to help with the financing and the dashboarding from a compliance standpoint. You as the seller can have additional capabilities in-house and or an ecosystem, so you can provide more services to package it to your buyer based off what you're finding out in a discovery process.
That's a good idea, actually. And I know some companies do that, but they're usually bigger companies, and they have where they've kind of like, oh, this is our platform and here's our managed services. But that's a good idea. It's like little ad hoc. They could have some teams that are already trained that, okay, for a certain time period, you maybe don't have to keep paying us for like a full year, but for however long it, you need to implement it here. When some guy leads, we'll come back and here's an extra, and you just pay us this extra fee for this specific service.
And it works for smaller and mid-sized companies too. It's even more, because even better, because like, hey, you can't afford to hire a developer. You can't hire this whole compliance person, the security analyst developer. Guess what? We package it on our platform for these challenges to make it easy to onboard you. So maybe you don't have the technical expertise. We've taken care of that and offloaded it. And we need some type of transparency in the cost model Because if you send somebody pricing for a platform play that does all this cool stuff, they're going to look at this and say, that's too expensive. That's where that education comes from. It's like, you could do it yourself. Here's what's on the market. Here's how many people you might have to hire yourself. This is how long it might take you to do it. But we've taken it into consideration and we rolled this up to deliver a capability to you to offload this. And that's one of the key things too. If you don't help the potential buyer or the prospect figure out that cost benefit analysis, they may struggle to figure that out and figure, yeah, it's just too expensive. It may not be based off what you guys need. So it may delay you for 6 months, a year, and you finally come back and say, yeah, you know what? It wasn't that expensive as we thought. We should have bought it last year. Now we're ready to actually consume it. So it's going to be a lot of listening on the seller side of what the problem is. Because you're the experts, right? We know how this looks. We have other customers maybe already. We've been in the industry for a while. And that's what we're paying for, your expertise on how to install it, how to implement it, what the documentation looks like. We want to make it easier to finance it. So all those details, you don't want to put that in front of the prospects. Otherwise, you're going to slow the sales cycle down. And you're going to make it very, very confusing for them. Like, okay, we bought it, but you said now we need another module for the other thing we saw in the demo. When you showed us the demo, we thought it was all included. And right. Prospect
Where in the buying cycle would you like to see each thing? Because I do agree. When you look at like the cybersecurity's like typical buying habits, yeah, it'll be like this zigzag all over the place. But then marketers are usually just dumping it in a funnel, and so do salespeople do it too. Like I know you get put in like a chain of emails.
Yes.
how would you like that information delivered to you?
Your team interacts with a prospect. You want that kind of confidence. We know a lot of the questions you're going to ask.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of know what kind of pricing and budget you're looking at in your mind. We know all the operability questions you're going to ask, the compliance questions you're going to ask, who's going to install it, who's going to monitor it, how do we do change management. We've thought about this, right? These are things you thought about before you even went to market, right? Because you are the experts and that's what you want to showcase. So we're going to show a couple of things. We think in the first year, you can only do certain things. So we're going to price it for that first portion, letting you know in year two, we're going to enable additional capabilities for an additional cost. So the problem is when the additional costs come in your weird spots where you need module 5, and it turns out you need to know day one, not in year 2 or 3, that frustrates the buyer. They're like, oh man, I really, really, really need this. But if you can understand better, like maybe you don't need it now. Maybe we have a process approved you can do to hold off on actually needing it. But we thought about how you're going to actually finance this, which is a key piece. If your solution is too expensive to use, it's not a good business model.
So would you like to see this during the demo, like from the AE, or more like by the time that the SE gets involved, or the pre-sales engineer? Like, when would be a good time for us to explain those other modules and sort of the value and the pricing and cost benefit analysis?
Oh, really, even closer up front, right?
You know, before you even get the demo,
right? Because hey, why are you going to demo something that I can't afford?
Fair,
right?
Like honestly, I don't even know why we're still selling this way. I will never buy a product. Like I'm thinking of as a consumer now, and most people I talk to who I even work with, they still tell us to sell this way. And you got a demo to see this. I'm like, I will never buy a product that tells me to talk to someone before I can see all the details.
Okay. And this is whole process where you can't go to the website, get the pricing. They force you through this funnel. We got to do a lot of meetings, a lot of demos, a lot of discovery. And it's like, oh my God, I think I need the solution, but you're making it very, very hard to get to it. Because the funny thing is, most presentations, they do all the cool deck, presentation decks, cool demo. And then the prospect is holding their fingers like, okay, give me the last slide. Give me the price. Or you email them the price afterwards. So great, great demo. And then 5 minutes later, you open it up, you see the proposal, look the number and say, we can't afford that.
No, you have to at least have starting pricing on your website. And then And that's sort of even my compromise. I would rather be even more explicit or include pricing calculators on there of like, okay, because sometimes you're asking people to do a lot of mental math.
Yeah.
And then I insist on FAQs too, that go on the pricing page. Of what does each of these little terms mean that we actually used?
Yeah. And then show the alternative, right? Because we need to know how big the problem is as well. So maybe your solution is $300,000. And then the CISO only has budget for $120,000. But the more question up front, you want to know how big is the problem, business problem up front.
Right. Like the potential cost of like beyond paying for whatever you need to pay for when you're breached, but your insurance costs, your loss of customers, any of that, like what kinds of business costs would you like us to kind of fold into that? Because like I want to start, I'm convinced that I need to just skip sales and I'll do sales enablement, but turn sales enablement into buyer enablement instead and just fix that whole model.
Well, the workspace construct, it kind of addresses this because we talk about enterprise risk management, right? This means it's one thing for the CISO to say they need $500,000 and then the CIO to say they need $4 million and the marketing department needs $6 million. Operation needs a certain amount. Product development needs amount. There's a lot of business things. We could have things in the marketplace that our competitors are catching up with us. We got more compliance and regulatory pressures. So enterprise risk management is the buyer side way of figuring out the total risk to the organization itself and help put a framework in place to help prioritize what should we address first. So do we accept the risk or mitigate it? And then from that, we need to figure out which piece from cyber, which piece from IT, which portion of operations need to be addressed, which kind of gets to the point of how big or how much should we be spending to do mitigation for this. And then you'll get into what a lot of people are looking at now is cyber risk quantification. Mm-hmm. So to help manage cyber risk better, let's be a little better about saying this could be a potential $10 to $20 million problem.
No, I see what we're missing now. You helped me just finally understand what we're missing. Most people get to that bottom number. They're not doing proofs like you would do in mathematics. And I've seen another company describe this, but in a different way. They were doing something else for vulnerabilities. But if you take that concept, it's like you're not what we're not doing is we're getting you the bottom number, but we're not mapping it to each cost, each person, each task.
It's a context,
We're just giving you the results, and you're like, I don't know where you got that, man.
Yeah. And even better, think about this. The CIO and CISO.
Like the right. Fairy got it?
Yeah. Because remember, that $120,000 is one of many numbers that IT has a list of things they need to go buy to put into their budget. So mm-hmm. when I say, oh, man, you only have $300,000, not a lot. You don't understand from my side, right? But you should understand they have multiple things they need to go buy and are competing interests here. So before the buyer goes out there, they understand their risk strategy and how much risk they're willing to buy down. So that plugs in also, if you look on this construct, is enterprise architecture, right? So all of risk management sits under the enterprise architecture, which is built to address the business needs and then what the risk environment looks like. That's mm-hmm. huge, right? So you just don't put technology in anywhere. Enterprise architecture sets the framework to introduce capabilities to the organization. And that's very specifically to support the business.
Right. I'm looking at a map now that you did of the enterprise infrastructure.
Architecture, yeah.
Architecture, excuse me.
And there are a lot of buyers and prospects who don't have a mature enterprise architectural capability. So they may buy technology ad hoc and don't understand how the components interact or how it directly supports the business.
Okay, so why don't you tell us about a couple things? So let me just, for anyone who hasn't seen your graph, or your diagram more accurately, there's a few things that you have on underneath the Smart IT buyer seller workspace contract. You have the enterprise risk management, enterprise architecture, which like includes roles, the IT operating model and cyber risk management. And then you have a lot of this other stuff about innovation culture, GTM strategy, the buying experience, and business marketplace. It's a lot to take in, but I'm sure you'll put that on a screen as you talk about this later. Yes. But I would love more details on what this means. It looks beautiful.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's a duality here, right? Because the buyer, in one case, is also the seller. So for any business, right? Say you're a law firm. Mm-hmm. So to actually run a law firm requires capabilities, and some of those capabilities requires technology, which means you have to hire people. You need to build an IT team, and you need to buy technology, computers, SaaS products, HR systems, all these things, and security components. You need to buy all this stuff. But you could also, on the other side is you need to make money. So you sell your services out in the marketplace, and you have a marketing strategy to let people know, hey, we have great legal services and all the things we do. So in most cases, everybody is in some case a buyer at some time to buy tech to enable business capability, and that business capability let them go out to the market to actually sell value back to the market. So one of the things to always be humanely understanding of the potential prospect is the fact that the seller is also a buyer. And you want to always think about what I buy from our own company, the way we go to market. So if you're a CIO right now, and you know you get hammered by all these different people kind of say, hey, I need 5 minutes. If the CIO walked down to their CMO colleague and observe how their company markets out, would it look different? Will it look similar? Is it more humane on their side when they go to the market and have to go blast Facebook ads and LinkedIn, right? So everybody's selling and buying in some aspects to support their businesses. So I give you a lot of appreciation for how you structure your go-to-market strategy that's built off what value you're trying to actually let the market know that you have. So it's kind of different. So this construct, you really to handle a lot of different types of personas, right? Because if we just took a seller, we could talk to their marketing people, maybe their sales VP, and then maybe their product person. And then we could also talk on the internal IT side and talk to the CIO, CTO, and CISO, right? And these different perspectives here. So the more the seller knows about kind of the pain points and challenges on the other side, the better they can construct their business model to actually go to market more humanely and be more efficient.
Right. So we need to think about like, okay, so one of their, so as a product marketing person, I typically do these early stage roles where it's a combination of product marketing and demand gen, a little bit of ops stuff.
Nice.
And that sounds like I'm special forces.
There you go. Right, that works.
Next career, maybe.
Yeah.
So one of the biggest issues we have is our teams are siloed and we're trying to bring them together to where we all have the same message. So it sounds to me like your IT, your CIOs, your CFO, and whoever else you have on your team, you guys are a little bit siloed and not kind of speaking the same language as well.
Well, you got to be, right? Because the silos can be happening on both sides. So maybe there's a disconnect between the company started. Maybe the company started 20 years ago. And then they have an entire product development team. And they do market research and forgot we want to do this new blah, blah, blah thing that's AI enabled. And they go build it. And based off how they're constructing internally, maybe the marketing team and the sales team isn't brought in till later.
Right. So, I briefly consulted on a product that did AI security. And it was one of the biggest challenges was knowing who was going to be on that team of who the end users and buyers were going to be. Like, I don't know if it's a CISO, is an AI specialist, is DevOps using this? Like, who's dealing? Is it developers that happen to have, like, who in the world is this?
And that's important, right? Because when you actually build the interface for the product, you need to know that, right? How are you constructing the interface? And by the way, it's going to get even wilder, right? Because we have a lot of interfaces that are mobile or web. We're going to have a lot of new things where it's immersive environments like with smart glasses and wearables. A lot of input will be voice.
Those are scary.
And that's a whole discussion about that because you really got to understand the user. And guess what? Every time you enable technology in a new way, you got to understand the risk And that helps inform how you're going to build it. You know, can they afford it? If I have smart glasses, what are the privacy implications? So one of the things we kind of the main foundation of smart IT itself is, right, a maturing an IT capability internally for all these companies. Because when their company says, we got this new thing we're going to go to market with, there's an underlying capability, a maturity that's needed to make sure you can secure the data, secure the infrastructure, you can move at speed and pace, keeping the right talent, outsourcing what you need, bringing all these partners in. You may have 300 people in your supply chain management. So if you don't have those things in place now and your product team is going way, way off, you may find yourself in this weird situation of having some breach on something that might generate a lawsuit. So that goes back to enterprise risk management. We want to be careful what we're building. We want to make sure we have internal capabilities to support it properly. So we want that governance structure, right? So we love innovation, but don't innovate to a point where you compromise the integrity of the company itself, right? So we're going to grow at a certain pace. You're going to actually introduce things into the market at a certain pace that you're comfortable for your risk appetite.
Right. So would you say this, like I think we're getting back into the VC model now, to where, okay, the companies are under pressure to scale really fast, hire really fast, and it's causing a trickle down effect where then a lot of people are losing jobs now, or either the people who stay are really stressed, and then it sounds like the buyers of these products are actually suffering as a result. Would you say that we need to fix that model so we can have more sustainable growth? That's or you had a different word for it. What was your word for it?
Got to go back and think about that. I think sustainable growth. We'll have to go back. What I said, I can't remember offhand. But the main thing is, if you're doing your startup to be bought, like a lot of them are, they want to buy out in a certain mm-hmm. period of time. When they go to back the market to get that bought out, sometimes the bigger company that's buying them, absorbing them, don't keep all the intricacies of the solution intact. And they have financial pressure on a larger organization that creates the incentive for them not to take care of it as well as the founder took care of it when they actually built the solution. So you're getting into things where people bought a product and a couple of years later, they just say, we're going to end of sale for this product. We're not doing any more development on it.
Absolutely. So what happened? They bought it because they wanted to lose that it was doing really well and they wanted that technology, but now they're going to lose all those early adopters.
Early adopters are going to say, hey, early adopters are happy early on. And then you sold and said, don't worry, we're going to have you more capabilities, more things you can plug into. Founder is off doing something else different. And then the quality might go down. Maybe they're not innovating as fast. Maybe the customer support starts to suffer. But early adopters like, I got to go look for something else now because we're no longer happy. So if you're really user focused, kind of an indictment.
Because I used to be on a team that absorbed those startups, like at a company.
Yeah. And so, their model and their business model is certain they got to turn things around fast. And they're always looking to crunch the numbers, right? We're going to buy these five new companies, absorb it. We're going to pop it into our platform. We're going to plug some APIs in. They got the new marketing slick that shows a cohesive platform. But then you look under the hood, it's like, these are the five different products and solutions you bought and bolted on.
Right. And so they're selling as a platform, but it's point solutions.
Point solutions. And then
you have to remember that the people who buy from startups aren't necessarily the same people who want to buy from the corporation.
Yes, right.
Actually, that's an exaggeration. Not necessarily. It's almost never the same.
Yes. Oh, now I remember it. Sustainable growth.
No, that's what I said. You had a better word.
I thought that was it. No?
No.
Maybe we both had the same one. Okay.
No, I said that, but.
Yeah.
Was it organized growth, a measured growth?
We'll go back and look at that.
We'll go back and we'll figure it out. It doesn't even matter. You could cut this out, even though it's funny when you leave that out. And
yeah.
We'll just say, we're over 40. We're allowed to not remember.
There we go. And think about this. If you take this like from a personal standpoint, like you never want to lose a customer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even if you buy a new tech, it's time 5 years from now, you still want the customer who bought your HR system to stay on board. Even after you add all this new stuff that's available, or you bought the SIM or a CASB or a DOP solution. I mean, people are having to shift constantly between these solutions from different vendors and manufacturers? Could it lose them, what you call it, not getting the value out of it? So you almost have to say, we're going to grow, but at a certain pace that we keep the problem-solving focus on a customer. We price it a certain way to maintain the ones we have, because that's the best way to do it, right? Why are you spending all this effort to market to find new customers while you're losing the existing ones, right?
Exactly. Like that. And you mentioned UX before. I'm like, that's one of my things. I try to look at, and sometimes it's not just me. A lot of marketers will say this, is let's focus on end-to-end customer experience and user experience, from no matter whether they're looking at our website, looking at our ads, looking at our product, looking at our demos. It costs more to gain more customers than it does to try to retain these people.
Yeah. What you're telling the buyer is, we kind of solved your problem before, but we have other interests which are going to make your experience suffer. Like how do I call and get a human? I'm looking through somebody's website. I'm like, my God. Or we used to open a support ticket a certain way, but they change it where it is. It's hard to get a human on the call. I call my sales team. The sales team is different. So you get the sales team different. The website's changed. Customer support might be looking. And experience is very, very kludgy, right? And that's where you get to, I'm going to go look for somebody else.
Would you rather get someone's cell phone number? Would you like a main line to call? Do you want to be calling someone overseas who has their customer support team over there? I'm guessing no on that one. Would you rather a chat bot, an email, like Slack? What would be best for you?
Well, contractually, when you started, you used to have an 800 number, and then you can call a sales guy in an SC, and the number was on their website. I logged into my portal and here's the support number I called and it picked up. So now you switched it and then you switched it overseas. And then you switched from overseas. Now you have a chat bot in front of it. So the experience is constantly changing, right?
Right.
So what's your value prop that we're going to make it easy to contact us, because we sold you the solution. We know how the solution works. We have expertise and we're going to constantly innovate, right? That's what you want to hear. We're going to constantly innovate and we're not going to hide from you to make it harder to get support.
So then what we need to do then in that case is, okay, as we grow, obviously the way to get in contact with people is going to change. We need to make it explicit. This is how, and then get in touch with you to let you know when something has changed. Hey, William, we just changed our number. I know you might have not seen that because you've got a lot of stuff on your plate. Here's how to get in contact with you. And by the way, here's something cool to read. Enjoy.
Yes. The other way, if the way it happens is you're at lunch with your sales rep and you're complaining to him because you opened a support ticket and it's been 2 days, you haven't got a response back. And the sales team had to go back internally and say, hey, okay, guys, can you look at this ticket? So you get a couple of things there, right? So if the product quality drops, it may trigger more support tickets.
Okay. So instead of more salespeople, we need more customer success.
Yeah, like once I buy it, I want a quality here, right? If I'm going to use this solution for more than 2-3 years, and you can tell by, right, the number of times people are switching partners and vendors, right? Not only partners for integration work or consultants, but also for the products and sale. It's a lot of shifting. You want to come out and say, yeah, our average customer for services is 5 years. They keep coming back. For our platform, it's like 7-8 years, right? We're making sure we're taking care of them. And to be able to do that, you have to have a very, very robust business model to allow you to finance that, right? So sometimes you may have to have across the board increasing in pricing, or you may find other ways to become more efficient in the background, right? But that's the fundamental nature of running a business. So if that business model isn't solidified, you can have a lot of struggles across the rest of the organization. And then marketing saying, you guys are doing all these cuts for customer support, and I'm trying to run a new marketing campaign. And then the VP of sales said, hey, I need to hire more salespeople, but you got to put a freeze in over here. So it's this constant motion of pressure on the dollars on both sides of the coin, which is always fascinating to me. So it's like, so you got the greatest technology ever and people with the money and they can know about it and they still never meet. And that's some of the frustration, I think, for a lot of people, because I still hear say, well, we got the greatest product ever. And we're like in eighth place. Okay.
Right.
And then maybe it's great, but maybe it's too expensive. Maybe it's great, but maybe the interface isn't great. Maybe the product great, maybe the support isn't great. But when you talk to your peers, they never mention you.
Because maybe that's also where we get back. Some products also towards the top may have a lot of hype because of good marketing, but they may not be. They may have their weaknesses as well.
Yeah. So one of the things with the smart IT model is they can be very, very diligent on the technology spend, right? I think the days of having zombie technology solutions sitting on the sideline wasting money is going to come to an end, because I think the financial pressure on companies are too great not to be very efficient with how you spend the money. So you want to make sure, and you want to know how it maps to a business function. Like, okay, these three technology solutions help power the back-end system that's for our mobile app. We know what those things are. We know how much it costs. So if we need to change suppliers, we have a good handle on that. And when the business said we need to help save some money here or there. So it's just a fascinating way of just increasing due diligence and quality across the board.
So really, how would you, I'm looking to see, because you have some very specific questions here. Oh, okay. Okay, so now you're getting into how IT buyers can help sellers. And then that's where you're, okay, so you're going to be evaluating the product quality. So can you go from there?
Right, because sometimes the buyers have been burnt so much, they've changed their behavior, mm-hmm. which now makes it harder on the sellers. Right? And there's a lot of workarounds for people and how to show up, from the string along to, okay, I'm going to give you some requirements. Maybe I might give you a generic budget range and timeline. And then, because they inundated with requests, sometimes they'll stop responding. And once you stop responding and giving feedback to a seller, it really, really becomes frustrating. Because, hey, we met your team. You gave us access to a lot of people. We gave you a proposal. It kind of met the timeline and everything else. When you just ghost us, it's like, whoa, what's going on there? So now it increases them to become even more pressure. Now from the IT side, they're saying, well, we're just being inundated. But if you had that human-to-human connection, we've met quite a bit, which is different from somebody just sending you an email out of the blue, say, hey, check my solution out. Mm-hmm. Other thing is to know your internal system better, right? Solid enterprise architecture. There's no ghost system that we don't know what they do or how they do it. We're always looking for ways to be more efficient. So we have to be more discerning when we ask sellers to come in and pitch us specifically what we need to know about. Sometimes they don't, which means you get the entire picture, which is too much information. And a very key thing.
You need to come in. So instead of us coming in with all of our diagrams and into the weeds stuff that we go into, it's better if we sit back for a minute and you bring us and you tell us what your architecture looks like today.
Right. What do you need? Otherwise, the SE will go in all these different directions. And they're not, call it, very specific on what they need to know. But make sure before you even get there, what are the critical questions and capabilities this needs to solve so we don't waste more time? So if IT isn't really clear about what they're looking for, then it can make the process much longer, because they have to do it multiple times, right? Because they found something they like, but internally told IT, I need three proposals. So now I had to do the same dog and pony show with two more actual options. So that's more work for IT, right? And you multiply that across all these different systems. So one thing that you can do I think we mentioned this before, is some integrators can actually take a lot of that workload off. And they really are consistent over year after year. They can make it easier for IT to interface with much fewer providers who can do back-end work on finding certain technologies. But yeah, but IT got to be more clear what they're looking for when they go to market. Sometimes it might be stiff arming. They walk into the conference floor. No, thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you. If they're going to do the demo, they've already scripted the response they're going to give to kind of shorten that process. And then we won't respond if you don't give us a very specific response of maybe these five critical needs. Because, you know, sellers would say, well, we can do three of the five things and we got option five is coming and requirement five, we really don't do, but we can do a workaround. So provide more upfront on what you're looking for to help with the screening process. Because sometimes you may spend 9, 12 months interacting, and then you just get the reply like, sorry, we want somebody else. So from the IT standpoint, you buy enough stuff humanely, like, hey, it was cost plus this feature plus this capability. In the future, you guys might want to address these two things. Really appreciate your time. Make it a little bit more helpful beyond just the standard. You guys are more expensive or went another direction. Because on the other side of it, you may need to come back to this company in the future. Because you ask sellers, they'll tell you, yeah, they went with another competitor, but a year later, they came back right back to us because they weren't happy. So find different ways that to make a smaller number of sellers you're going out, that you're dealing with, be more upfront on what you need and what the criteria are to get to it quickly. So if you only got $100,000 and we've already done the due diligence on special financing and spreading payments out, we've already done that, it's $100,000. Then you can save the seller a lot of time by saying, yeah, we're at $400,000. So nice meeting you. And they just end it right there and save a lot of time.
Right. And then that's not even the time to talk about price cuts or anything like that. Because then it's like, kind of seems different.
Can you get a discount? So that's the worst thing, right? You're forcing salespeople to talk about 10% discounts early on. It's like, no, it doesn't meet our technical requirements or our compliance requirements. Like, we have data privacy requirements that you guys don't have. Well, can you get a 10% discount? Why are you going to give me a discount?
About those. Can you tell when people are sometimes, I read a lot of marketing websites and I spend a lot of time sometimes actually talking to people who do this stuff. And then sometimes I find out that what's written may not actually be accurate. It's in their roadmap. Can you figure that out? Like how long does it take you to figure, or if you can, like, how do you figure out how long does that take you to realize that someone's doing that?
You ask when you do things like, can I talk to some references who's already done it in my industry? And then if you're 4 weeks later and they still haven't come back with somebody, that's a sign. That's a bad sign. Or you can kind of trigger it when they say, we can do it through an API. So you guys can't do it now. Well, we can do it. We got some workaround. We can bring services team in to help do it. That's another way to figure it out. You guys can't do it. How many other places have you done it at, right? So you're trying to get to how long have you been out there doing it? And then can I actually try it out with my own data? And if you get kind of hesitant, you say, well, it's kind of hard to do it. The demo's easier, but there's certain things where they hesitate on their side to kind of give indication. Now, the ideal world is to say, yeah, we can't do that. We're 3 years out from that. We probably won't do that. We can't support. That's the ideal state. But like you said, you have to ferret out from a conversation that, yeah, I don't think it's going to be a good fit.
That makes sense. And it's kind of like another CISO told me that he'd rather people just admit that than exaggerate what they can do and just say, hey, this is on our roadmap. We're new. Like, but you can do this now. And if you stick with us, maybe later we'll do this. Yep. And some companies will be okay with that. But you're never going to earn back that trust that you lost.
Yeah. And sometimes that salesperson is under so much pressure because maybe their territory isn't large enough, or they're relying on the marketing team to give them leads. So
marketing team, because they're under that pressure for those leads, and because sometimes maybe we don't get to have the conversations that we need to really have with the people that we need to be having them with. We do the best we can with the information we're given, and that information may not be accurate.
Which leads to the question, how many actual real potential buyers do we have in this area or this state or this country? Because you have some companies who kind of fudge the numbers with a national presence, and it's like 3 or 4 very, very large contracts, which making up 60 to 70% of all revenue. So it skews the number. So like if we had like 100 salespeople and they all had to work in one state, could they eat? It might be a no. But if you have a rep spread out one per state, so you're almost wondering like how viable is our solution? And then we're putting a lot of work in there. If the salespeople had to go this hard, instead of just telling the truth, they're trying to prolong it. They're under so much pressure. Maybe the market's smaller for us than we believe. So that gets back to the product fit and do you have the right business model? Because maybe we don't need 2 reps for the entire country, but we have other solutions in our portfolio that are more prevalent out there. And it's easy to find people with that problem. Because you can't say we look across the entire country and we can't find anybody with that problem who doesn't have a solution already, who can't actually afford us. There's like this disconnect here. So it's that great.
It almost reminds me like you use a lot of analogies. Like, so imagine you're making music, and there's a joke that it's big in Japan because like you have some guy in his basement making really weird music, and not even a dive bar will let him play. And then he goes to Japan, and they love it.
Yeah.
You're selling the wrong thing to the wrong people. You need to go, or maybe you're just playing with toys. Maybe this is not a product. Maybe this is a game.
Yes. And that's the key thing. And find out sooner rather than later. Right. I got a hobby. I've got something that only works in dive bars. After people have been there for 4 hours because they're a little inebriated and they can't understand good music. So, okay, how many places are like that? And here's the size of our company we need to meet that particular need. That would be very helpful. As opposed to, man, they just don't understand. They don't understand good music. They don't understand good tech. They don't understand great food. Should the food's good? But here's the thing, though. If a company's in business, though, they have found enough customers to say, we like that. We just need to know how much you can grow that. How much will it cost you to find those other people? The greatest solution ever. It was just when I had been there. What? That doesn't make sense.
Now that sounds like your average marketing pitch. The greatest solution ever. You're like, the solution to what? You tell me.
It's better, faster. And then here's the other one. Can marketing, they'll say, we have an addressable market that's billions of dollars. Hold on. Mm-hmm. How do you come with that billion of dollars, right? Because when they say it's billions of dollar addressable market, so all we need is like this little sliver.
They get into some report, and then that's why. And I also consulted with a team that did something like this. They wanted to market to the addressable market because they said this particular problem that this will solve, this market is expected to be some astronomical number by this date. So we're going to hire tons of people and we're going to ramp up our marketing to sell this. And you're like, yes, that's a projection. And there are a lot of people who had the same idea based on that report. So what exactly does this solve right now? And who would be interested right now?
Yeah. It's because if you come back and say, we can't find them. Do they exist?
I mean, they might. I mean, maybe they're just confused because everybody had the same idea all at once because they get some report that says, this market is explode by $3 trillion by 2030. And so I'm gonna go and buy it kind of reminds me a little bit of when, you know, back in the early 2000s, maybe late 90s, people were selling like all of these potions you could mix in their drink. And it's like, and it was almost like a Ponzi scheme. I guess it was a Ponzi scheme. I can't keep track of what pyramid and Ponzi, if they're the same or different. I don't know. But some kind of scheme. They go on because they thought that there was going to, and then people would say, oh, this is a millions and millions of dollar market. I'm going to go sell to all my friends. And then you sell to all your friends and we're all going to be rich together. Yes. And that's what they're doing. It's like these companies, they're hiring their friends to start talking about this big report. And then nothing's happening.
They got past their friends' friends. And after that, nobody wanted to take their call. And then they go and figure out, okay, is it the pitch? Is it the message? Maybe we need to say it faster. Maybe we need to go to more conferences. Maybe we need to do more giveaways. And they like trying to figure out, where are these people and why isn't our message resonating?
Right. I even found one. I talked to one buyer of a product for a place where I consulted. He was not using the product the way that they described.
That's a good point.
Not at all. Not even close. He was using it. I'm not going to say what it was. It's like, it's not something I advertise. I don't advertise like the consultant stuff on my profile for reasons like that.
Yeah.
A very nice guy. And I was very glad that he was honest with me. And I wanted to write a case study, but I wasn't allowed. Because of that reason. Yeah. He wasn't. Like they were selling us some big platform that did X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
There was a tiny little subset that they said fed into this platform.
Yeah.
He was only interested into it for that small piece. He was the only, and he would only validate And they would use him like in these reports and stuff to say that him or someone from his team was someone who would give him a reference or validate them, but they were leaving out the words and how he was using it. But it was this little piece that was maybe at a stretch a quarter of what they were saying the product did. That's and what he was saying worked for him was because of that. And then that was just one tool. He had tons of tools for that specific need, and it was feeding into something else. I feel like if I sell too much, it would be a little bit too specific. So I'm vague on purpose here. That's so it's one of like probably 20 to 50 of those kinds of things that he had that made up the bigger hole that he had that he was able to solve. So it wasn't really that product.
That happens very often. It might be like GRC platforms where it never really implemented totally completely the way it's capable of. They say, yeah, we just use it for that one report out of that one module. That's an expensive way to do it. It's like, you can see, right? Because you look at the way technology implemented, it's like, it's been used in a slightly different way. Everything's not turned on. And you wonder, did the use cases change? Did the requirements change from buying it, you know, evaluating, buying, and implementing it? Why isn't it operating like that 6 months from now? And yet that's what one thing IT has to be good at, right? Reevaluate what the technology stack looks like. And can we change things out? So one of the things that locks them in is the pressure for cost containment is, hey, don't do a one-year deal or contract. We can save money by doing 3 or 5 years, and we get this great discount, and the finance team loves it, which means you could be locked in for longer than you want to be. So sometimes you're not.
Loves it, but I've heard that buyers hate it because then they might be stuck with the dud.
Yes, and they try to make it work, and then maybe 80% of the features are never used. And you're like, this is a waste. And that waste sometimes can go unseen, right, from the business aspect. All know there's a box on the dashboard that said, and this is even worse from a security standpoint, we bought these 5 security tools to mitigate risk, and we're going to help reduce risk by X amount of dollars, and we're safer. And then you go and find out 3 out of 5 aren't completely implemented. The other 2 aren't optimized. So if you redid your analysis, you'll find out they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So you're not mitigating risk the way you thought it was. It's more like a placebo effect. But everybody say, hey, dashboards are green. It says it's implemented. Great investment. It's like, is it?
I think that's why a lot of I've heard security buyers not even loving solutions that are just advertising as new dashboards now. They're like, I don't want to evaluate everything. I have all that stuff. Just tell me how you fix it.
Yeah. Or even other thing is, we have 70 controls just under security, not counting things that IT has. And they ran a penetration test from a third party, and they went, got in, exploited some critical systems, and then no alarms went off.
Right. So now we're getting into your new solution that's supposed to fix vulnerabilities or solve other security issues, actually creating security issues.
Security issues. So the fixes weren't happening automatic. Things weren't being patched. The sensors weren't catching things that should have. The new AI engine may have did an alert, but nobody did anything with it. So all of a sudden you start to question the efficacy of the security program, right? And if the security program isn't effective, that means you're not managing risk well, not managing cyber risk well. What else aren't you managing well? And at the end of the day, that's a business failure right there, right? So a business can't say, well, it's too technical. We don't understand it. So I guess back into making sure you hire the right outside people to come in to validate what you're doing is actually doing what it's saying it's doing.